I have disclosed two financial relationships which are in the system and which I'll show you at the end. I am Wayne Riley, president of the 144,000 member American College of Physicians. Delighted to be here in Chicago at this great meeting and to talk a little bit about how we see the integration of our work as the nation's largest medical specialty society representing internal medicine in terms of public health issues. This is the ACP's 100th year. We were founded in 1915, so we're very special honor for me to serve as the president during the centennial celebration. We are the largest medical specialty society. As mentioned, we represent primary care general internists like myself, plus subspecialists, cardiologists, pulmonologists, endocrinologists, gastroenterologists, etc. We have a very diverse membership, a growing diverse membership. We publish Annals of Internal Medicine, which is sort of the gold standard journal in internal medicine. And we also offer MixApp, which is a CME program for our members, and also publish ACP Internist, which is sort of our weekly or bi-monthly newspaper. And we have a zillion of educational products and programs, which I don't want to go into today, but clearly we're very proud of what we offer our members. This is the internal medicine workforce in general, almost 290,000 internists in the United States, 64% men, 36% women. We have about 35,000 internal medicines in residents in training at the moment, 250,000 active internists, meaning they are still practicing, seeing patients, or participating in clinical work or administration. 47% of us are subspecialists, as I mentioned, and a very healthy percentage of our members are IMGs, which we are very proud to have so many of our members, international medical graduates who bring richness to their communities and their work around the country. This is an editorial published by The Lancet last May, which really marked our 100th anniversary. And the key quote that really animates my year and my work as president is that we are looked upon as the conscience of American, the conscience of the medical profession. And this is something we take very seriously in terms of the positions I'm going to tell you about shortly. But clearly, we were very honored by this editorial in the very prestigious journal, The Lancet, that marked our 100th anniversary. Now, in terms of public health and primary care, you have to think about this in terms of the road, the two roads that sort of diverge. And we have taken some very muscular public policy positions that are very closely aligned with public health. And I'm going to focus on the Affordable Care Act a little bit, more time on LGBT disparities, vaccinations, and firearms, because we think those are the recent issues that closely align with integrating the work of primary care physicians and the primary care community in terms of public policy and making a difference towards a healthier nation. Let's talk about vaccinations. We all know what was occurring around the country, principally in California, with regard to vaccinations. From our perspective as internists, we took, again, a very muscular response, calling for basically no non-medical exemptions for vaccinations. We communicated that to members of the California General Assembly. We wrote op-ed pieces. And some of our members in California testified within the health committees there. We're very proud that that turned out as it did. And as you know, subsequent to that, for those of you from California, there was an attempt to get signatures collected to get a ballot initiative to undo the position of very few non-medical exemption. That has fallen short. So we think that this, for the moment, is this policy, which has broad public health implications, is safe for the moment. But it bears watching, and this is the type of thing that we will continuously monitor in terms of vaccination policy around the country for its obvious public health implications. So specifically, we support the immunization of all children and adults according to the standards established by the U.S. Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, CDC, the National Vaccine Advisory Committee. We support state laws designed to promote all recommended immunizations, and we call on states to pass legislation to eliminate any existing exemptions except for medical reasons from the immunization laws. So again, we've taken a very muscular position that we think serves public health and primary care very well. Now, pivoting to the Affordable Care Act, there's lots of sessions here in the Affordable Care Act that many of you will attend. But in terms of our advocacy, we were vigorous supporters of the Affordable Care Act as it worked its way through Congress. More recently, with the two Supreme Court cases, we filed amicus curiae briefs on both cases. And if you look at Justice Roberts, the key punchline in his opinion, 6-3, in Burwell, King versus Burwell, said that Congress passed the ACA to improve insurance markets, not to destroy them. And so operationally, we think that that is a key legal underpinning, which really makes it somewhat more difficult for any subsequent president to upend the key aspects of the Affordable Care Act, because by the time the next president is in, close to maybe 20, 21 million people will have insurance through the Affordable Care Act. And no matter what the political rhetoric you hear on Fox News or CNN or MSNBC, we think it's going to be awfully difficult to upend this. Now, our position has been that the Affordable Care Act does need improving. We are there with many people there, but we think that the President and the Congress got about 80% of this right. There's another 20% that needs to be fixed, so we work with AFP and many of the organizations up here to try to improve the Affordable Care Act. So in terms of, again, public health, we think that having insurance at broad-based universal coverage serves the interest of primary care and public health very well. Now, talk about health equity, because we have been focused on this in terms of what has been the Affordable Care Act on underserved populations. So just in the African American community, 6 of 10 African Americans qualify for Medicaid, CHIP, or lower cost exchange plans because of the Affordable Act. Almost 8 million with private insurance have better preventive services, no copays, mammograms, et cetera. 500,000 young adults covered on their parents' policies. 2.3 million gained insurance, decreasing the uninsuredness rate by almost 7%. And 95% of eligible African Americans could be covered if the southern states plus two or three others would expand Medicaid. In terms of Latinos, the same story. 8 of 10 qualified for Medicaid, CHIP, private exchange plans. Almost 9 million Latinos had access to preventive services. Almost 915,000 Latinos obtained insurance through their parents' plan. 4.2 million gained, 95% would be eligible in those states that have not expanded Medicaid, if we can get to that. Shifting now to another topic we feel very passionately about, and that's healthcare disparities. We have long-standing policy addressing healthcare disparities of about 15 years. We did an undertaking to look at what is the state of care among the LGBT community, and what we found was somewhat disappointing. And so we put together a committee that came up with, we think, a very progressive, forceful policy that calls for better care for the LGBT community. Again, the specifics are that we know that there's disparate treatment. There's strong evidence that LGBT patients our neighbors, our coworkers, don't get the care they need when they need it, and there needs to be an addressing of this from a primary care perspective. So we're very proud of our position paper on LGBT care, and I was delighted to see that the PRIDE study is about to kick off, which is a longitudinal Framingham-type study of LGBT communities that we think will enrich the database in terms of care of special populations like those communities. Again, our view is that we ought to decrease the barriers to care for any group that has inequitable treatment. And we also have called for states to enact discriminatory statutes to eliminate discriminatory statutes so that LGBT community have full access for their loved ones and others in terms of taking care of them during their illnesses, et cetera. We went even further. Gender identity should be included as part of non-discrimination and anti-harassment anti-harassment policies. We called on health plans to include comprehensive care. The definition of family, we said, should be inclusive, that all hospitals and medical facilities should allow patients to discern who they consider their family, who may visit and who may act on their behalf. And we did support civil marriage rights for same-sex couples even before the Supreme Court decision was rendered. We also, again, call for data collection and research. That's why we're very happy about the Pride study. We want better curriculum in our medical schools and residency training programs to care for those special populations. We oppose conversion therapy as being not a very effective and not a good use of healthcare resources. And again, we supported continued reviews of the blood donation policy with regard to men, homosexual men, going forward. Now, pivoting to the biggest issue, I think, of the moment from our perspective in terms of prevention is firearms. At least two of the organizations up here, along with us, and I think American Preventive Medicine, three of us. So four of us signed on, five, APHA, this meeting, and the American College of Preventive Medicine, the American Academy of Family Physicians, American College of Family College of Physicians, put out a call to action with the American Bar Association colleagues. When was the last time you heard that lawyers and physicians are working together? Well, we have come together in what we consider very common sense reforms to try to decrease firearm violence in this country. I don't need to tell you the number of incidents that have occurred within the last week. There was one yesterday over the weekend in North Carolina. So we have to do something about firearms. And we've come up with some very common sense measures that do not abridge the Second Amendment, because we know that's where our friends at the NRA go, right to the Second Amendment protections. But these are very common sense things that we've called for. They are background checks on all firearm purchases, whether that's gun show, you buy it from your uncle, you buy it at the gun shop. There has to be some robust background check system. It is clear that Mr. Roof, who committed the murder at Mother Emanuel, probably should not have been able to purchase that gun. There was a mix-up in the background check, and et cetera. So we really think this has nothing to do with the Second Amendment. Next, eliminate the gag rules that prevent, in certain states, Florida in particular, a physician asking a depressed patient, "Do you have a gun in your house?" And we have filed an amicus brief in that case because that infringes my right as a physician, my First Amendment right as a physician to counsel my patients in the confines of a patient encounter. We call for a ban on assault-style weapons. I come from Louisiana. It's a hunting state. I had uncles and cousins who hunted. I had an uncle tell me, "Wayne, if you need an assault-style weapon to hunt a deer, you need to pick up golf." So these weapons, there's no use for them in outside of military purposes. And again, it does not abridge on the right to hunt and to participate in riflery, et cetera. Mental health issues. Even though the percentage of individuals who commit firearm violence who have clear documented mental health issues is low, we do know that mental health issues can impact suicide, self-infliction of harm, et cetera. So we obviously call for better public health, broad-based, community-based public health, which went out of fashion, unfortunately, many years ago. Reporting laws, we do not want reporting laws that get too overly prescriptive, that if someone tells me in the confines of a patient encounter that they've had some issue with depression or so forth, we don't want that to be a deterrent to someone legally owning a gun, but not so that it then becomes so onerous and so conflicting with their First Amendment, Second Amendment rights to own a gun, that then puts a chill. And obviously the need for research. There's been a sort of a federal ban through the budgetary process on collecting data. And I know all of us are data wonks. We want the data, we want the research, we want to be evidence-based. So these are our calls to action in terms of firearms, which we will be pushing quite vigorously. Other things that we've talked about, LGBT care, the impact of immigration. We did put out a policy paper that says that mass deportation would cause huge public health problems. And again, people thought this came out because one presidential candidate has been opining on this, but we have long-standing immigration policy that that says that mass deportation could cause public health disasters. So again, we also are working on a policy paper on climate change, which we expect to deliver sometime in the spring. So again, the nation's largest medical specialty organization, very assertively, very proactively addressing issues of public health that have bearing on primary care of our communities. Thank you.